I asked him in my first interview, people are tweeting about you around the world right now. Can you help me understand? Like, there's so many kids who are sick out there. There's so many stories. Like, why you? And I said, I'm not being mean, Tyler. I just want to know why. Why you? And he said, because I asked God. I told God when I got cancer the second time, don't let me waste it like I did the first time. But if you will you please use this story, use my life for your glory, whether I live or die.
I was really hard on myself because I felt like I hadn't really used my story for the Lord's glory. I felt like I could have done more with my cancer to glorify the Lord. I went through some really dark patches, lost, ruined a lot of relationships, lost a lot of friends because of just how I dealt with things. So I was really hard on myself, and I felt like I just hadn't done enough. And so when I was diagnosed for a second time, I felt like it was the Lord really pushing me to turn the whole struggle over to Him and just use it for His glory.
From the Family Life Podcast Network, this is Unfavorable Odds. I'm Kim Anthony. Unfavorable Odds is about finding hope and help in those seasons of life when things are pretty tough. You know, Jesus has promised us that whenever we walk through those dark valleys, He's always with us. We will never have to go it alone. So on each episode of this podcast, we'll be talking with people who have learned how, during those dark times, to draw their strength from Jesus. Tyler Trent was a 20-year-old student at Purdue University. At age 15, he was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, a rare bone disease, an aggressive form of cancer. Tyler burst onto the national scene when his story went viral on ESPN and social media. He was passionate about sports, raising funds for pediatric cancer research, and most of all, he was passionate about using his story to point people to Jesus. One of Tyler's dreams was to write a book that would carry on his legacy long after he was gone. Well, he accomplished that goal with the help of his parents, Tony and Kelly Trent, and collaborative writer, John Driver. I spent some time with John, and I was able to get a behind-the-scenes look at the life of a young man who asked God to use him to have an impact on the world. And then he saw God do far more than he ever thought possible. John, you got to have a bit of an inside look into Tyler's life. Tell me a little bit about who you are and why you were able to get this opportunity to serve in such a way.
Absolutely. You know, it's still something amazing to me that I even had a part at all in this story, because it really is an incredible story that's changing lives still today, and an incredible young man. So I'm a pastor near Nashville, and I'm the teaching executive pastor here at my church. But for about 10 years now, I've also worked as an author and a collaborative writer. And so it just sort of was something God really led me to do. It was kind of out of the blue, not something I thought that I would do. But over the last several years, collaboration's really become a passion. It's a way for me to partner with somebody who maybe doesn't have the opportunity or the time, the energy, you know, the bandwidth to give to a project to really help interpret their message. Especially, I work with a lot of different speakers and pastors and other people that, as you know, what you say to the public doesn't necessarily translate to the paper. And so I really consider myself an interpreter in that way that I help. So my agent, who's a dear friend, reached out to me in October to tell me, hey, you know, I don't know if you've seen this video that's going around, but this family is looking quickly to try to work on a book that's one of Tyler's dreams before he passes. And so he was already a writer, you know, for his newspaper there at Purdue, had written a lot of of different op-eds and other things and different newspapers around. And so he had a great writing voice already, but I had that opportunity. We immediately, the next week, jumped in a car, drove to Indianapolis, and began the process of capturing as much as we could with him and collaborating together. So it was just an honor, and he was an amazing inspiration to me from the moment that I met him in his home, and he was in a hospice bed there in his living room they had set up. And he was just a delight. Even in that situation, he was already paralyzed completely except for his right arm, but still pretty quick-witted and had a lot of funny things to say. Very intelligent, very sharp, and just a young man that's impacted me deeply.
Describe what that collaboration looked like. Did you have conversations daily?
Sure. Well, I mean, collaboration is different in every various project. It always is something that's going to vary depending upon the situation. With him, and I wrote about this some in sort of the writer's note up front, because we knew that people were going to go, okay, you got a guy who's paralyzed, who's laying in a bed, and, you know, in the last couple months of his life, we're supposed to believe that he, you know, penned this book on his own. And most books don't happen with somebody sitting around writing them by themselves anyway. It usually takes a team. And so having a writer, his mind being a writer's mind, helped a lot. And so immediately I just began capturing audio recordings, set up a microphone, and that's how I usually do it. Just begin to take in, and then you transcribe those files. But the amazing part of this was that there were so many people who had other footage. In fact, there was a guy named Scott who was a friend of theirs that went to church with them, who just felt led by the Lord a few years ago to just start capturing as much video footage. It was when he was diagnosed with cancer for the second time, and they went out to eat and just asked him, hey, this is weird, bro, but can I just start following you with a camera and interviewing you? And so there was a terabyte almost worth of footage that he had just taken when Tyler was still way more mobile and able to get around. And so that kind of followed so much through there. So all of that was shared. And the ESPN, who had done all the documentary work, that, you know, it only was about a 2-minute piece that they aired that day, but there was hours of footage with different members of the family and other things that they just graciously shared all of that as well. And then finally, his parents, we knew when we started, there was a chance that he would never get to hold this book in his hands, and that he wouldn't be around to help us polish off every word. And so we were very intentional about, hey, what is it that you really want to say? What are those predominant messages and stories and those things? And then his parents have really been the stewards of that. Tony and Kelly Trent are just phenomenal people. And so they became the stewards of his story while he was sick and while they're caring for him. And then after he passed as well, helping it be accurate, helping it have all the things inside of it that we knew that God wanted to say through Tyler's life and Tyler wanted to express in his own story.
You also give his parents an opportunity to express what they saw during Tyler's life. Whose idea was that? It's brilliant.
You know, I think that in the beginning, we knew that they would most likely be the ones who continued to carry the story. And so we wanted them to be able to speak. And also, you know, there were things that they wanted to say about Tyler. He was a very humble young man. There were things they wanted to say about him that he would never say about himself. Okay. You know, you couldn't talk about how intelligent he was and brilliant and all those things. And so they wanted to dote on him and have that moment to really enjoy their boy in the book. And so it was painful. And that process is still painful and difficult because it was the craziest collaboration process timing wise I've ever been a part of. We initially started and began sort of the standard pitch to publishers type thing. And as things became more imminent with his health, it became apparent we had to move faster and we had to take a less traditional route. And so we ended up basically writing this manuscript in about 30 days, which is usually would take about 6 months to do so, just to pen the original part, not, you know, much less the edits. And so everybody sort of swarmed around, and Tony and Kelly, in the middle of what all they're doing, of course, they're traveling to the College Football Hall of Fame to accept this award, or they're doing interviews, but above all, they're caring for Tyler. And one of the last events that he did was the Music City Bowl when Purdue played in Nashville, which is where I live. And so we met up there, and he had a special suite at the Gaylord Opryland hotel, and he was, you know, the guy who went out on the field. That was one of the last times he had the energy. He really didn't have the energy. He didn't think he could make it. He was very, very close to passing. I think that was December the 28th. And they wheeled him out on the field for the coin toss, and he was the honorary captain for both teams that day. And then literally by the time they had him back in the tunnel, he was beginning to go downhill just at the Music City Bowl. And so they put him back on the plane and flew him home. So all that's happening as we're writing. So I went to the hotel and met with the family, but all of that is a part of the book. So we're literally experiencing it in real time, a lot of it, as we're writing it, which was the most fascinating thing I think I've been a part of. And seeing God move in those things, watching the family, you know, be willing to share honestly the things that they're struggling with, and also how the gospel is unveiled and revealed through Tyler's words and through the things that they want to say. And really going back and forth, you know, usually you have a lot of time with the publishing team to go, hey, how is this going to work? What message we want to say? I mean, they were making those decisions really from a raw place. And it was just pure. It was a pure thing. And so it's again, so much pain and grief, mm-hmm. and yet so much joy and hope. And that mixture of the two, it was just a place where you could really see the work of God.
What kind of guy was Tyler before his life was interrupted?
You know, I didn't know Tyler, but I have seen a lot of video and obviously talking to his friends and being even at his funeral and all the childhood stories. And of course, a lot of time with his parents. And I can just say that his nickname was Smiley, just always a smile on his face. Really a jokester, very intelligent and loved to cut up. There's so many great stories about him and his friends playing board games, you know, until all hours of the night and the early morning, very competitive in that sense. And so always witty and sharp. And really sort of the life of the party, if you will, even though he was, you know, he accomplished a lot. He was always a good student and those kinds of things. Those things came naturally to him. But really just the guy with a smile on his face and always a happy word for everyone around him.
Walk me through how Tyler found out about his cancer.
Yeah, so it was, you know, a couple crazy stories because, you know, he went through this several times. But the first time, he just had this pain in his arm, sort of up in his humerus area. And he had been playing basketball. He was in summer workouts for basketball and just kind of had attributed it to a muscle pull or a strain. You know, when you're that age, you're 15, you know, you don't freak out. It's growing pains. All kinds of things are happening. And so they had spoken a little bit with some just medical friends. Oh yeah, well, you know, put some ice on it and try this. Everyone just assumed it was sort of a sports injury. And it went on. And he and his mom wanted to go to the doctor sooner. And he always had a trip. You know, it's that prime of life. He's off to this camp and off to this event. And so he threw a Frisbee at his best friend's birthday party and had just the most incredible sharp pain in his arm. And after that, it was almost immobilized. Mm. He had to put it into a sling. And that was when they began to suspect maybe it was more than just a muscle strain. He still insisted and waited and tried to avoid until his mom just forced him to go. And basically, you know, in the moment when they're doing the scans, she can detect from the reactions of the people in the room that something is terribly wrong. And so he'd actually broken his arm throwing that Frisbee. Mm-hmm. That was how the tumor was so involved and had weakened the bone so much. He actually broke his arm in that moment. And you know, that was the beginning. Immediately, their lives went from everything you think about in a normal teenager's life mm-hmm. to something completely different. And it was never going to be the same again.
How did the diagnosis affect Tyler?
He, in the beginning, especially after he started his treatments, and this is something we write about in the book quite a bit, and something that's one of those sort of middle grounds on how people will think of it, and we wrote it that way. You know, Tyler hit a deep, dark depression, even became suicidal at one point throughout the course of really starting treatments.
You know, when I was first diagnosed, I was 15 years old, so now I was very immature, I would say. Yeah, no, I entered a state of depression, you know, of questioning God and, you know, asking the questions of, hey, you know, am I ever going to be able to throw a football with my kid one day? Because of the way osteosarcoma works is before they had any treatments, they just amputate your arm. They just, you know, get rid of the tumor. And they had told me that, you know, that's scary for 15-year-olds. And so there's a lot of, you know, am I going to live? Am I going to die? And I entered a deep depression because of that. And basically I had decided in my mind that I was either going to kill myself or the cancer was. And I actually tried a couple times. And by the grace of God, did not succeed.
He really felt bad when he went into remission and sort of had grown in maturity. He constantly felt a need to sort of make up for that in the years to come, even as he was fighting cancer a second, third, and fourth time in different ways. But during that season, it just hit him, and he became very bitter. He became bitter against his friends who were experiencing all of the novelties of adolescence and all the things that we all want, you know, to experience. And he's in treatments. It was about 9 months, especially, where he's in treatments and surgeries and other things and always recovering. And I think the thing as parents, we try to really bring out in the book is that he was also dealing with chemo brain, you know, is what they call it. I don't know what the official medical terminology is, but that, you know, he wasn't himself. I mean, he had a lot of different poisonous chemicals going through his body. He's dealing with treatments in a way that affects you psychologically and certainly even chemically. And so he, again, was just the kind of kid who held himself very responsible. He wanted to be responsible. He took life very seriously and his role in it, and he wanted to steward his life well. So he spent his life really repenting for that. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people around him said, hey, bro, I mean, you were doing the best you could do with what you had. But it was a hard, hard moment for him in life, especially not knowing if he would make it through. Osteosarcoma is one of the most aggressive forms of cancer. And there's not really a lot of new treatments. I mean, there may be new techniques or new equipment, but the basic way that it's been treated has not changed in 50, 60 years is what they had discovered, which is one of the reasons that the Trent family is so passionate about cancer research. Also because about 95% of funding for cancer goes to adult cancers and not to children's cancers. The survival rate is much higher among children because they, you know, have the ability to adapt and all those things. But he just was facing these really heavy realities at such a young age, and the whole family really dealt with the weight of it, and it hit him like a ton of bricks for sure.
I believe I read that his parents said that when Tyler got cancer, the whole family got cancer. What are some of the things they experienced as a family when Tyler was going through his treatment?
Yeah, that line when they said that to me affected me so deeply, not just as a writer, but just as a person, because it is such a profound truth, I think, to anybody in a family situation who is dealing with something on that level, certainly something so severe and life-threatening. I think that the hardest thing was keeping up with it all. Tony, and they each had their own things, and I respect them all so much for what they dealt with individually and respectively. You know, Tony in particular is trying to still provide. You know, he was a small business owner, owned his own business, and felt the need to continue. But of course, they're running to a different treatment every day. He's homeschooled, but in a homeschool co-op. And so there is once a week that he's in a classroom environment, and then that begins to change. And so they're dealing with him, his depression, and Kelly is running back and forth, you know, basically becoming nurse. In fact, one of the hospice nurses pulled aside Tony after Tyler had passed and just said, you know, Kelly Trent may have been the most remarkable mom who did more for her son during all these years than we've ever seen, the people who were beside her the whole time. So she fully immersed herself in caring for her son. Well, they have two other sons, you know, Ethan and Blake as well. Mm-hmm. And so this was hard on them. You know, it's a complicated question, but yeah. So dad's dealing with it, running around, asking God to save his boy. And he's there for his son as much as he can, also trying to provide and deal with all of the ins and outs of it. And Tony's a real self-proclaimed, he wants to be in control if he can. He wants to try to affect the situation, and what dad would not want to positively affect the situation and do as much as he can to relieve the stress and pressure, but there's just only so much he could do in this situation. And then again, Kelly just went into caregiver, complete caregiver, lost herself in that role. And then there's a chapter in a section that Blake wrote in the book where he really talks about how he got into some negative things in his life that he felt lost. His faith was shaken, mm-hmm. you know, and not just, I think, faith in God, but really there's this feeling when you're young that you're invincible and immortal. And no one has to tell you that. You just kind of assume. And even if you see grandparents or other people in your life pass away or deal with sickness, that's one thing. But when your own brother, who you share a home with, someone close to your age in your generation begins to deal with that kind of mortality and that kind of suffering, it just shook him at a foundational place. And God reached out to him in a remarkable way to bring him to a new place of faith. And so it just, everybody sort of found their way through it. I think even in the aftermath, when Tyler went into remission, which is such a happy moment, it's really the part of the story they remember the least. For about a year, really? He was cancer free. Yeah. And they don't have a lot of, they don't recall a lot because they had lived at such a frantic pace for so long. And with so much unknown around them, they took a trip to Hawaii. I think there was a Make-A-Wish mm-hmm. trip that happened during that time. And they kind of just have vague passing thoughts about it. It really, depression sank in for Kelly because now the constant giving of herself and having no self-care caught up. There was tension, you know, between them in terms of how do you go back? How do you go back to a quote unquote normal life after mm-hmm. dealing with all they had dealt with? And so, even in health, it wasn't like it just went away. They were forever affected. And then always, there's that fear hanging over your head, that cloud that, you know, this is a highly reoccurring cancer and a highly reoccurring diagnosis. And so as much as they want this young man who's now about to graduate high school and finally go to college and has this bright future, he's on scholarship. I mean, he's brilliant, all those things. There's just that nagging feeling, and they learned to live with it and put their trust in God completely. But it was always there, and it was a reality that did come, you know, eventually to haunt them again. So it was difficult to know just when the situation itself would be resolved. There was no resolution they could find outside of being 10, 15 years outside of it. But in the immediate couple of years, it was going to be a constant reality. Tyler's cancer became sort of the thing that they revolved around in terms of daily life.
How do you come alongside a family like the Trents who were dealing with cancer to provide support and encouragement? What do you say? Some people would want to maybe say nothing at all and disappear from the scene because they don't know exactly what to say.
We talked about it a lot. In fact, Tony and I were speaking last night on the phone, and I just said, hey, I want to just, we both know God put us together. That was evident from the get-go that me being a pastor as my day job is the other thing that I do. I mean, I'm around hospitals and death and suffering and all those things. And I believe all of God's people. I don't think you have to be a professional pastor or somebody on paid staff. I think that's God's will for all of his people, that they would, in that kingdom of priests, that they would be the light and the ones who carry the weight for those around them. I think that's really the call of the gospel upon our life that we often miss because we sort of pawn it off to the quote unquote professional staff.
Right.
But it was something familiar, I think, is my point of that. And I've learned a long time ago that I don't know enough to speak into situations beyond what is encouraging or beyond what is me just really being present. And so I did my best in those moments not to counsel, you know, and I think that's a good thing for anybody out there, that if somebody's going through something like this, it's easy. And even Tony talks about that in the book. Hey, if you want to share a scripture, there's a way to share it
mm-hmm.
where it's not a, hey, this is going to make everything okay now. And, you know, instead of a, hey, in humility and in brokenness, I understand that this weight, I'd like to share it with you. Maybe this will encourage you. And I'm not trying to fix it. I'm not trying to take it away. And I'm right here with you. We don't have to say anything, you know. And so just tried to be there with them. You know, for them, getting into this crazy book writing, you know, journey that we took over the course of those few months, in particular the one that we're writing, it gave them more to do, you know. And in fact, not just with the writing of the book and the story, but I mean, Tyler went everywhere during this time. I mean, he's in a wheelchair, he's got tubes going everywhere, and they never just sat at home and waited for the inevitable. They decided, they made, and it's in their, the book is a moment, they decided we're going to live life for as long as God gives it to us. And we're going to let our boy experience everything. And so those moments were really the most influential of Tyler's life, where he was speaking hope to millions of people. He was a nationally trending topic on Twitter. He's on ESPN all the time. He's being interviewed by Robin Roberts. He's, you know, he's everywhere, and he's sharing his hope that he has in Christ as he's doing all those things. And so it was an amazing time. And yet behind the scenes, I was with him in Atlanta. You talk about coming alongside a family. We were just in a mall. He was there for the College Football Hall of Fame. He's sitting next to, you know, everybody who's in the sports world, who's famous and Heisman winners, and everybody's around, and they're all coming up to get Tyler's autograph, and they're all coming up to talk to him. It wasn't put on. Like, there was a genuine sense that, in fact, even some of the ESPN guys would say to me, like, we just don't know what it is about this kid. What is it about this story? There's, you know, lots of people out there who are sick and lots of tragic things, but this one really did something to them in their hearts. And so that's all happening as we're walking through. People are stopping to get his autograph, but we went, I'll never forget, we went to just a Chick-fil-A in a mall food court, and the whole family's there, and some of the Purdue University representatives, and David Blau, the quarterback, who, you know, plays in the NFL now, just an incredible young man who loved Tyler and cared for him so well. And we're just sitting there, and they're just a normal family. And Tyler, his medicine, you know, would cause him to be emotional, and he would be uncomfortable, and something about his tubes or something about his situation would need to be changed. And there were medical supplies that they needed that they forgot to bring. And so they had to drop ship them. And so they're down in the foyer of the hotel trying to get all the equipment they need. And then, oh, by the way, the little brother, you know, got the wrong drink and he needs a different drink from the place. And they have to find a way to wheel him through, like, in all of the midst of just this crazy, amazing story that's internationally known. Mm-hmm. You just see this family just having to be a family as well. And they still have to pay bills, and they still have to, you know, figure out how they're going to transport from this place to this place. Of course, with a disabled young man as one of their children at the moment. And so we'd be in the bookstore shopping, and I'm just laughing. I mean, of course, I'm the writer, so I'm taking this all in. And I was a former youth pastor as well, so I love watching teens and kids, and you know, watching the little brothers, Blake and Ethan, are shopping for these things at the College Football Hall of Fame, and asking, "Hey, Dad, can we get this?" Nah, you know, and they're having that same talk that any of us as parents have, while their brother is in a wheelchair next to them and doing an interview on ESPN. So, coming alongside them, I just really tried to be their friend, to answer your question, to try to listen to what they wanted to say, to try to add comfort. There were a lot of conversations we had that I felt really honored to just be present. We'd be on the phone, and maybe I could just speak an encouraging word, or maybe I could remind them of something they had told me that encouraged me, and they still do. And I think it was just, again, God put us together, not because, I mean, there were 1,000 other writers who could do the job better, but I was honored that God allowed me to be able to serve them, because I really wanted to serve them. This was more than a book project. This was a chance to come alongside, like you said, a family, and love them through something difficult that I've never been through. And they all hope that we never have to go through, any of us. But there are those who do go through it. And so these are people who are speaking truth and hope in the middle of that pain. And it was an honor to get to be next to them.
I love that not only were you able to contribute as a writer of Tyler's story, but you were also able to contribute as a pastor, as a listener, as someone who brought comfort to their lives. It's truly divine, divine appointment for sure.
Absolutely. It's so humbling. So, I mean, truly humbling to just, and we throw that word around a lot, but truly it breaks me, you know, to think about it. And these are just precious people. And it gave us a lot of opportunity, because of pastoral background, to really decide, you know, how to frame the message. Because the main message of this book is the gospel. And that's not popular. I mean, he's not in Christian circles as much. I mean, Christian circles know about him, but he's on a national stage. Yeah. And even the guys today, the SportsCenter anchors or whomever, who are tweeting about this book. And when they are tweeting right now, they're not just like, "Hey, we love Tyler, you should go read this." You can tell they've read it. Like, there's something of substance to what they're saying, that this is something deep and moving, and we're addressing suffering and sovereignty and mystery and the middle ground between all of those things. in going back and forth. And I loved so many nights on the phone with Tony. Tony and I especially would spend the majority of our time on the phone talking through the details. And we would have these big time gospel conversations like, well, are we really going to say this or this? And how does this affect the person who's reading from this perspective or this perspective? And there was, it sharpened, you know, because we got to be together and it sharpened what it is they really wanted to say in the middle of a moment they knew would be a once in a lifetime moment for Tyler. So what is his message? And it was just so beautiful for me, like you said, as a writer and a pastor, to get to witness that and people saying, hey, we know in the middle of our pain what's most important to say.
You mentioned a little earlier that Tyler wanted to fully live his life. And one of the ways that he chose to fully live his life was to go to college at Purdue. What did that mean for Tyler?
Well, his dad was a Purdue alumnus, but he liked to kind of pick and poke at his dad a little bit growing up. And so he was actually the exact polar opposite of a Purdue fan. He was an Indiana fan. Which was you know, almost like heresy inside the home. And he writes in the book, he did it just to bug his dad, you know. So they had this banter going on back and forth. He also thought he would be going to NC State. And there was a moment there, he was in remission at the time and had been offered what he thought was this big scholarship. And then there was a mix-up in the offer. And so he would celebrate it. He was all excited. It was just this roller coaster ride. And then found out that it wasn't what they had said it was and was very disappointed and turned his eyes a little bit towards Purdue as a possibility. And in retrospect, then seeing that immediately, but before he could officially enroll, he was going to be back in cancer treatments. In fact, he had a hip replacement like 2 weeks before class started. And he said, I'm going to school. And so you could see the video. Mm-hmm. There's video of it in the ESPN piece where he's literally on crutches walking onto campus after just having a hip replacement and still undergoing chemo treatments. And so Purdue meant a lot to him. And so people, they don't know about the Indiana NC State thing unless you read the book, because he is known as the Purdue super fan. Like, right. He's the guy, you know.
I was actually surprised to hear that he was IU fan before that. And then there was an NC State element in there as well. But God is so in control. And God placed him at Purdue, which you would later learn that, you know what, that's where exactly where he needed to be.
Well, and I think he would have been the number one guy on campus at any school that he went to, because that was just sort of his way. You know, and that was God's path for him as well. He had that effervescent personality, that ability to go all in. And so he actually, you know, Purdue sports, and he was a sports writer. That's what he really, you know, wanted to do. He actually enjoyed the statistical side of things. And mm-hmm. so he was constantly crunching numbers, and he was one of those people that would memorize all the stats for all the figures of his favorite teams for years and years, and could recite who did what in 1965 on what day. And so he had that brilliant mind, and he was applying it to where he was. Wherever he was all present. And so he was going to be all president at Purdue. And they were not a very good football team. And that's the thing. Tyler was really a part of the impetus of sort of a wave of change across the spirit in terms of, you know, school spirit of what happened at Purdue. And so, of course, he goes and makes this famous, now famous prediction on national television that they were going to upset number two Ohio State, who was undefeated mm-hmm. at the time. And he actually had, you know, the year before had actually camped out when nobody camped out. There was no need to. He camped out. He came straight from a cancer treatment and camped out on the concrete.
You know, the media first picked up my story because me and one of my best friends had a really stupid idea of camping out for a Purdue football game, which was unheard of. They wrote a story on us, and there's this kid with a crutch who's bald camping outside of the Purdue football stadium. And why was he bald and on a crutch? Because he had just had chemotherapy and, you know, just had pelvic reconstruction surgery and was crazy enough to camp out for a Purdue football game.
So the coach came down, and Coach Brom came down and met with him. And that's where the local news stories really began to pick up what was happening with this kid who had cancer. And then, you know, so it's just amazing. Purdue meant everything to him. And one of the things that got me, I don't know if you read this in the book, but the president of Purdue at, I believe it was at commencement possibly, or sometime towards the end of the school year, mm-hmm. when he was speaking to the student population, he said, when you look back on your life someday and what happened to your life, you will remember that you were at Purdue during the year of Tyler Trent.
Wow.
You were there for his time. Like, that's how, I mean, there's a, they're naming and putting up a whole memorial for an entrance to the stadium. I think it's right where he had camped out. I mean, there's scholarship funds named in his name and lots of cancer research in that area, in the Indianapolis area. So, I mean, it's not just that Purdue meant everything to him, because it did, but man, he means everything to them as well, still to this day. It's a beautiful relationship they have.
It is. He really impacted that campus, and he's had an impact around the world.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Purdue-Ohio State game prediction. Talk about those days for Tyler leading up to that big game.
So Tom Rinaldi and the ESPN crew had picked up his story, and they were on campus, if I remember correctly, about a week or so before the game. And so that's where they're shooting all the interviews and all the footage. Well, they didn't realize at the time, and if you watch that interview, his words are very garbled, very belabored, because he had these tubes in his kidneys that were necessary for his kidney functioning, and one of them was actually malfunctioning. They didn't know it at the time, and so he was really becoming toxic and was close to death, and they didn't realize when he's recording all of that. I mean, everyone knew he was terminal, but he almost went down that week. And so that's why, one of the reasons why, with the medication, everything, that he was so emotional in the interviews, in terms of he couldn't stop himself from crying and other things. And there were times he was like that, but there were also times after that interview where he was not like that. I met him after that interview, you know, and he was a little more himself. Mm-hmm. And so that week he did the interviews and went through it, and then they weren't sure he was going to make it. I mean, they went to sleep he had a surgery. Very, very painful surgery.
Talk about that.
Yeah, it was a surgery where basically he felt everything, that the anesthesia did not work, but he couldn't tell him. And so he had felt, and all, some of the details, and I hope you get to speak with his parents at some point, you know, because mm-hmm. his mom especially can correct and tell you exactly all those things. And so some of those details are not going to be as accurate with me, but my understanding was very, very, very painful, and they weren't sure if he was going to recover. And it's Friday night, they go to bed, you know, knowing that this could be close to the end. And of course, the game is the next day, and they mm-hmm. wake up on Saturday morning, and it's like a miracle. Like, he's not cancer free, but he suddenly feels 100% better, more like how he had felt, you know, up before this kidney crisis. And so they decide to go to the game, and that day is my favorite part of the whole book, is him describing and him talking about that day, because so many unique things happened that day. Obviously, they did upset Ohio State, and mm-hmm. that was one of the things that caused that. And of course, the story aired that morning on ESPN across the nation, so it becomes this huge thing. And he just basically, by the end of it, they have Secret Service agents that are, you know, taking them to the game. They're in this suite up top watching, you know, and just, it's just dignitary after university official, after anybody that they can come up to come meet him, ESPN guys, everyone to come and encourage him and speak with him. He honestly said it distracted him. He had trouble watching the game a lot of the time because of so many visitors. And so, you know, that's a part of his journey. And then he ends up going down to the field towards the end and even into the locker room. And the locker room scenes are just amazing. Mm-hmm. And he gives a little speech. And it was all for Tyler. The players, I mean, these players loved this kid. Yeah. And he had been around a lot because he was a sports writer, had interviewed a lot of them. And a lot of them would just, I mean, he was a very good sports writer, very good interviewer. And so they wouldn't acknowledge when he was talking, you know, writing for the paper, for the Purdue Exponent, they wouldn't necessarily acknowledge that he had cancer. I mean, mm-hmm. they were very professional, and he was just Tyler. And so now they knew, and they would talk to him off camera or outside of the interview, off the record, about those things, but they loved him. He really was the captain, always their captain, you know? And so it was such a special moment, just a God moment, that brought his story to national prominence, But I think it's such a treasured memory, always was for him, just that moment. And even when, after the first interview, I was driving away from Indianapolis and we were thinking about book titles and concepts and all those things, and just the upset just jumped into me like, man, this is it. Like, the whole thing is his life is this upset and this crazy underdog story, and there's no way Purdue can beat Ohio State. There's no way that he can win in these odds, and yet he has hope and he keeps making these just crazy predictions about what hope in life is really about, just like he did for that game. And so it from the get-go, I think, encapsulates exactly what God did in this young man's life.
What did that game day do for Tyler?
It energized him. Tyler did not want to talk about himself. He really, really didn't. That was one of the main things he would always say when he spoke. He would say, you know, I really wish that, I don't like that we're talking about me right now. I wish I could hear about you and your story. Everyone has a story.
Because my whole thing at Purdue was, you know, hey, everyone has a story to tell. There needs just to be someone willing to listen to it. And so that was really important to me.
So he got a lot of attention that day, and he wasn't the kind of kid that, and I'm sorry, I call him a kid. I know he was a young man. I did just let you know how old I am, not how young he was. But, you know, he didn't take it in some way that made his head big. He took it as love. Mm. I mean, he really felt the love of people. In fact, Ohio State fans were cheering for him, especially when it came down on the field. I mean, that's a bitter rivalry. I know that sounds silly, but, you know, in college football, those kinds of things are not...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, not very common. And so they would even say things like, hey, if we had to lose to somebody in this manner, we're glad it was to Tyler's team. And there was such a support for him there. Mm-hmm. So that day felt like love to him, both from God, that God would allow him to have, you know, a spark enough to go through the process. In fact, they were in the locker room still at 1 a.m. and it was about time to go home, and they didn't want to go. Even when they got back to the house, they didn't want to go to sleep. It was like,
didn't,
you know, it was
end.
That special. Yeah, it was a full special day that should have never happened in 100 different ways. It was just a gift. And so for him, it just energized him.
There was one point in the book where Tyler says that he arrived at the stadium and there were signs. People had signs with his name on it. And he said, I couldn't believe that they took the time to make a sign for me. And I thought, oh, how precious this humble young man who just demonstrated the love of Christ, the humility of Christ, in the midst of such excruciating circumstances.
No, absolutely. I do believe that God uniquely made him to be who he was for what God was going to do in his life through the brokenness of this world and all the things. And obviously the balance between suffering and sovereignty and mystery and all those things is something that we don't try to answer completely. We do, you know, in the book, talk about what we do know, and there are a lot of things that we don't. And it doesn't belittle or take away the pain of people in suffering and all those things. But you did have, I think, a unique young man who did feel that his journey was the journey that God allowed to happen in his life and was going to use for his glory. In fact, he said, and it was such a strange thing to say, when he got cancer the second time. In fact, if I asked him in my first interview, and it sounds so insensitive. And so we had been speaking for a little while, so I tried to be delicate. I just said, okay, Tyler, man, here you are. You're funny and smart, and this is a tragedy, and you're laying here, you know, mostly paralyzed, and people are tweeting about you around the world right now. Can you help me understand, like, there's so many kids who are sick out there. There's so many stories, like, why you? I said, I'm not being mean, Tyler. I just want to know why. Why you? And he had the answer. And I think only people of humility would have the answer. And he said, because I asked God. I told God when I got cancer the second time, don't let me waste it like I did the first time. Don't let me waste it. But if you will you please use this story, use my life for your glory, whether I live or die. Now, he wanted to live and ask God. You know, he didn't resign himself and never stopped fighting. But no matter what I have to go through, would you not let me waste it and be that guy who lost hope the first time? He said, that's why. That's the only explanation. He's like, there's no reason. All the guys, the ESPN guys who say, I don't know what it is about this kid. In my mind, I'm sitting there going, I know what it is. I mean, this was a divine thing that was an answer to a prayer that is still being answered today. Every time that we get to discuss this in a forum like this, and every time someone opens the book, and it's such an encouragement to know that his humble prayer was something God took seriously. I think God takes humility seriously, and that he is thinking and dreaming above and beyond what we can possibly think or imagine, what we can't do on our own, and not even imagine God has those plans for us. And so Tyler, I don't think ever thought it would be this. He never thought. I mean, he didn't necessarily like that. I mean, now being on ESPN Sports Center was like a dream for him as a sports writer. So he had those moments, that he really enjoyed. And so it was really cool for a guy who was so sports driven and interested to have so many cool sports moments.
Yes.
But above it all, it was an answer to a prayer from a humble heart that said, if I'm going to suffer, hey, I want it to have meaning and purpose and to bring you glory and light. And I believe God is still answering that prayer.
What were those last days like for Tyler?
I wasn't there for a lot of the last days. In fact, I saw him on December 28th, which was my birthday. And so we went to Opryland and met up with the Trents for a few minutes, and I could tell he was pretty bad off. We were discussing more research and different things, and I talked to him a little bit, and my wife got to meet him, which was a special moment. And they asked us to leave the room a couple times. They had several hotel rooms, but because he needed to rest, so I knew it was pretty bad. And then again, hearing, later on, like I said, they had a big talk where he just wasn't sure he could do it. And he made this big faith declaration, like, hey, I'm doing this. Like, it was this regardless of how I feel. So then he began to really decline, almost as if that last, and not to be cliche or to make light of something so weighty, but in many ways, it felt sometimes as if like Purdue's football season sort of went the same way that those few months of Tyler's life did, because he was so connected to them. Mm-hmm. And so, they got destroyed by Auburn in that bowl game. It was, but they never were supposed to be in that bowl game. They'd already had a better season than they thought that they could. But it was almost as if like it was time for their season to end. And God had, again, I know it sounds, I'm not trying to hyper spiritualize sports and athletics and those kinds of things.
I get it.
But for him, his friends were on that team. And his commitments, it was a stewardship thing to him. Like I said, I was going to be their captain. Like he would say things like that. I'm going to finish this. And so I think that God even honored that, regardless of whether God cares about football outcomes and those things, I'm not speculating on, but there was something bigger than the game going on.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the beginning of the end. I really didn't hear much. I was, in the holiday time and researching and of course thinking I got to get this done and working on it for a couple days there. And then I began getting the texts on New Year's that he had passed. And so the reason I hadn't heard, because Tony and I, spoke daily often, many times a day during those times, and I didn't hear from him for a bit. And so I think I texted him once, and he had said, yeah, things are pretty bad. And so they took their family time and friend time and all those things to really say their goodbyes and gather around him. And I'm sure something that they would share in a much deeper capacity than I can. I can't imagine the pain and the difficulty of it, because it's their boy, and their brother, and just so much there for the family. But he never lost hope. He never stopped trusting. One of the things he would do is when he couldn't speak anymore, he would do numbers with his fingers, 1, 4, 3, and it would mean I love you. He never stopped loving on his friends and family and all the way to the end. So, and I can't imagine again the devastation, but the hope we have in Christ has taught me so much. It's not like pastors know everything. It's not like that those things don't affect us. I mean, the human condition is something that we're all supposed to feel so that we understand the magnitude of the grace of Christ and understand the magnitude of what he's done. And I think sometimes when we theologically try to rise above, you know, almost intellectualize things to a point that we don't feel, and especially when we're quote unquote professionals in Christianity. And I think it causes the world to not understand necessarily exactly how much grace has been given and what we're being delivered from and how the brokenness is being addressed by a rescuer. And so it affected me deeply, you know, without having all the answers. I can't imagine how it affected them, but man, the hope that continues to go forth from it just reminds me that this is bigger than me and bigger than all of what we do in religion. It's bigger than whether or not we have all the right answers, that Jesus is the protagonist of this story of creation and humanity and history and eternity. And because he is, we can trust and rest in the fact that he will complete all of the plans that he has for us. And then it's a good thing that we're not in control and in charge, but that we have one who's trustworthy, who is.
You and Tyler did a tremendous job of helping to illustrate God's grace in Tyler's life. The details he gives about what he experienced, even in his chemo treatments, it really brings the reader into the story and helps them to see the things that they weren't able to see on national television, the behind-the-scenes things that the Trent family went through. I believe that perhaps there are people who would never even give the gospel a second thought, that Tyler Trent was able to reach because of what God allowed him to go through. I think of all the sports figures, and there are people who probably, you know, atheists who don't really give faith a chance. And they were able to see this young man's life, and it softened their hearts, I believe, and it allowed the gospel to seep in. It's amazing. And I think, what could God do with us, whether we have a short time on this earth or a long time? What could he do with us if we would just yield ourselves, if we would just say, as Tyler said, if we would fully live for him and give it our all, even until the end?
No, you're right. And, you know, a topic of conversation often was we could put pretty gospel bows on this. And the Trents just said no. You know, there's a chapter in there that is hard. It's really hard to read. It's after, you know, the story follows him chronologically, but there's a chapter that's by Tony and Kelly that they really wanted everyone to know exactly. And it's graphic in places about what it was like to care for someone going through what he was going through. And they talk about friction, the friction in marriage that comes from that, the friction in their home, the mental constraints of it all, and then the physical caring, like 24 hours a day, you know, for a young man who can't walk, can't get to the bathroom, can't, you know, whatever. And they did that because they didn't want, I think, I pray and hope everything you're saying is true, that there are those whose hearts are softened in a way that they wouldn't have been willing to acknowledge before, because it is a unique story. And it does have a unique opportunity, it seems, in the culture. It has a unique window that still hasn't gone away. It still hasn't gone away. We're still telling the story in ESPN last week, you know, when they accept, or they're gonna, I think it's going to air this week, and he's accepting the Stuart Scott Humanitarian Award at the ESPYs. And it just continues. Even Disney and ESPN and all of these companies that know that this is an explicit telling of Jesus. I mean, no one's hiding that here. And I don't know, that's exactly what Tyler dreamed of and prayed for. And its effectiveness and limitations, you know, we won't know. It's one of those things you won't be able to measure by book sales or measure by how many likes on a Facebook page or how many views on a YouTube video. Like it won't be measured in that respect. And there were hard conversations along the way when we worked with, you know, various people, editors and professionals as we're getting that book going. Like, they saw there were other ways to say this, like, hey, you know, an unbelieving audience may struggle with this, you know, this part or this part, because it allows there to be mystery about who God is, you know, and we're not just saying, oh, God's great and nothing bad ever happens to his followers, you know, and though that's not necessarily the message that is constantly explicitly stated, there's a lot of people who that's what they believe. And so then they're constantly disappointed in God,
right?
Either as believers or unbelievers, because they feel that there's a promise that's been broken that was actually never made. And mm-hmm. so the promise that has been made is often not even been heard. So they're basing their viewpoint of Jesus and his goodness and their hope upon a gospel that was never even in Scripture. And so Scripture and bringing out that reality felt like to the Trents. I mean, it was a mission for them. Hey, we want to say this. We want to be willing to mourn. We want to be willing to hurt and invite people in and say we don't have all the answers to all of that pain day to day, but we have a hope that is above and a hope that is deeper that keeps sustaining us. It doesn't mean we're all happy-go-lucky and skipping down the sidewalk all the time. It just means that there literally is something bigger than life and death that is happening in us that we're leaning into and that brings us hope and strength to walk through something that is unwalkable. So absolutely, I pray everything that you're saying happens, that God continues to use that as a seed in people's hearts, and that it continues to ramp up. You know, I pray that this message rings forth for years to come, and that it has a thousand other ways to get out there, mm-hmm. whether it's more books, you know, different versions, audio books, whether it's movies and other kinds of things. I hope that Tyler's story continues to draw people to that, because that's really all he wanted. That's what he wanted, especially when it became apparent that, hey, his earthly life was not going to go the way that he had originally planned. And so he just immersed himself in a different plan, and it was beautiful. And it still encourages and equips me today. As a guy in my 40s, it still causes me to think, wow, there's something bigger here than just a kid who had a good attitude. There's something deeper here that God was doing. And it reminds me and encourages me that God's divinity is greater than our humanity, and that we can rest in that. We don't have to work our way through it. We can rest in it.
Amen. Tyler was very passionate about finding a cure for pediatric cancer.
Yeah.
What was he able to accomplish?
Well, I mean, he's raised there, you know, the V Foundation, various foundations, Riley Children's Hospital, all kinds of organizations through Purdue and other places have raised millions of dollars. And he's partnered with them in various ways, and his family still continues to partner with him in various ways. And so the money is a big deal. Like I said, cancer research for pediatrics is a field that needs to continue to grow. And so he took that very seriously. And he would meet with other patients. I mean, he was a hero in the hospital. I mean, he was like a celebrity and would meet with kids all the time, you know, and he's there for his own treatment, you know, but he took it very seriously. And the bottom line, the thing in the book that got me the most, though, to answer your question, they're called the T2 cells. He donated cells from his cancer to research that are literally growing. In fact, there was his parents told me, and it's something that, again, they tell the story so much better than me. But the other day they were at, I think it was in Arizona, possibly, they were at a facility where research is being done, and their son's cells were active and live in a tray right there in front of them.
My goodness.
They're growing them to explore how to help this not happen to other kids. But it was a part of their son's life was there, even though it was the bad part, the hope that was being brought to other people through those things. And so, I mean, again, the T2 cells was just the most fascinating thing I'd ever heard of, that not only would someone donate those things, I can see that, but that even those are Tyler Trent big, Tyler yes. Trent, Tyler Strong, you know, like it's got that, it's got that hashtag type feel to it, that God's going to let every part that has been used for bad and suffering in his life, he's going to redeem every part, and nothing's going to be wasted. in the end, certainly for eternity, but nothing's even being wasted now, that there's so much hope for them. And so I think just those cancer cells that may save another kid's life being still there from Tyler's body are just, wow, that blows my mind, the way he's still affecting the dialogue and the conversation about pediatric cancer.
That's incredible. It really is. Well, as you mentioned, Tyler Trent stepped into the presence of Jesus on January 1st, 2019, at the age of 20. How's his family doing?
You know, I think that it's one of those things when I speak with them, I mean, it's grieving and mourning, and it's not something I could answer directly to know. Only they could say what it is. They're continuing the work. They're continuing the work of what they're doing. Of course, the book came out, you know, a few months after that. And so for Tony in particular, we talked about this. It seemed to give him a continuing task of Tyler's, a continuation of one of the things Tyler wanted to see happen, which he wanted to be an author. He wanted to write a book. And so, you know, in the immediate aftermath, I mean, we're still on the phone. We're still doing interviews and talking through details. And it's all so fresh because, you know, he's just passed. And that was hard. But I think there was also some therapeutic moments to it. This is what I prayed for. And I would tell them that, guys, let's stop talking anytime you want. You know, you don't have to answer anything you don't want to answer. And they were always so gracious to me in that respect. But also I think it gave them the chance to see, hey, I mean, this is going to go into a format that will never go away. You know, sometimes when I work with authors, I'll tell them that, hey, you know, someday when you die, your story will continue to live on if this book is sitting on a shelf somewhere. And so knowing that his words at the age of 20 will still be ringing 20 years from now, mm-hmm. maybe 50 years from, who knows, I think brought them comfort. But in all reality, they're devastated. I mean, they're devastated. They've lost their son. There's nothing you can say to bring him back. And they're leaning into Jesus, into their community. Tyler's funeral was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Their pastor, you just talk about how God sets people up mm-hmm. to be in the right community, in the right place at the right time. He just released a book about the biblical act of lamenting. It just happened to be coming out almost at the same time that all this is happening. And he talks a lot about lamenting. Even lamenting, he says he's going to do a book down the road of lamenting for the purpose of racial reconciliation. Mm. And I mean, like, instead of us just trying to fix everything, sitting and talking about how much all this hurts and sitting and listening to one another. And so the funeral was so God-honoring in that respect, in that they grieved together. The book opens with "You Are My Sunshine." Those were Tyler's words he wrote out of the gate, his exact words. And he wanted to open with his voice saying those things. At the end of the funeral, they walked out singing "You're My Sunshine," all the crowd, everybody who was there. And they went to the lobby and they had some refreshments. And the deal was, if you wanted to go greet the parents, and there were thousands of people there, that's fine. It was going to be an exhausting night for them, and they're gracious and did it because everyone loves them. But what they really wanted you to do was stand around and share a story about Tyler and share something that had happened. And so there was just all this just bustle of conversation going on among thousands of people sitting around glorifying God as they honor Tyler. And so I think, you know, I hope and pray that, and I told them that, this, I guess, that counseling side of me, like, I just pray you guys lean into people who love you, lean into family, lean into me. I'm a long ways away. I'm in Nashville, but call anytime. But it's just a process they're going to have to continue to go through, that they'll never be the same. And God will restore and redeem all things.
He does.
For the moment, they're a family that lost their boy, and my heart just breaks for them. The short time I knew him, it's affected me so deeply. I can't imagine as a father. I can't imagine, what that's like. And so I think that they still need our prayers, that we need to not, you know, it's easy for us to talk about Tyler and this amazing story and all those things and forget that, we still need to lift up the Trents and Ethan and Blake and grandparents. And, you know, grandma would bring, when I was there the first day, grandma would bring him his special drink from Starbucks every day. And it's such a special relationship, you know, and, you know, imagine, you know, losing a grandchild and all of the things that the family's facing, and how holidays are going to affect them. And, you know, the first of everything is going to be so difficult. So mm-hmm. how they're doing, I think they're doing as well as anybody I could ever imagine. And I imagine that's pretty hard.
Will you please let the Trent family know that I'm one of the many people who will continue to pray for them?
Absolutely. I'd be honored.
John, thank you for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kim. And let me share about a young man that just really impacted my life. It means a lot to me.
I'd say legacy is really important to me. So leaving a legacy, what it means for someone of my age to leave a legacy and leave an impact on the world.
As I consider Tyler's story, I'm reminded that God is good, really good. He's present, he's full of grace, he's merciful, kind, generous, trustworthy. Tyler prayed for God to use his life, his story, his struggle, his pain, to reach others with a message of grace and redemption. And it all started when he made the decision to fully live life and not to just survive. So I had to ask myself, have I decided to fully live my life? Or am I allowing the fear of the unknown or fear of change or whatever else to keep me in survival mode? Now, don't judge me, y'all. I have had seasons of fully living life, but lately, life has gotten a bit overwhelming for me. And I sometimes find myself just trying to survive, trying to make it through another day. So seeing Tyler's determination to live every moment to its fullest, it's convicting. What I face in my everyday life is nowhere near as difficult as what he went through. Now, why did God allow Tyler Trent to get cancer? I don't know that anyone could answer that question but God himself. But if you will, I'd like to speculate. Maybe it's because God knew that Tyler would grow closer to him as a result of the experience. Maybe it was because God knew that Tyler could be trusted with all that God wanted to do with his life. And maybe God was thinking about all the people who would never be open to listening to or reading the gospel without this extraordinary story surrounding it. Tyler's story translates the gospel in a way that disarms and embraces the masses with this message of hope in this world and beyond the grave. As you think about Tyler's story, would you please pray for his family? I can't imagine the pain that they're experiencing right now. To many people, his story may be something that is here today, gone tomorrow. But his parents, his siblings, his family, they will miss him always. I'd like to close with scripture that Tyler wrote on the door of his hospital room during one of his cancer treatments. It was 1 Peter 5:10. It reads, "After you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you." Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information about John or his book, check out our show notes on the Unfavorable Odds page at familylife.com/podcasts. If you enjoyed today's conversation, I hope you'll consider subscribing to the podcast. You can search for Unfavorable Odds on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you go for podcasts. Oh, and by the way, we'd love to get your feedback, and any positive reviews are greatly appreciated. On the next episode of Unfavorable Odds,
they were talking about preserving fertility and chemo, then a mastectomy, then radiation.
Yeah.
And at 26, you hear people talking about years in advance, and you're thinking, well, what are you talking about, years?
Josh and Allie Taylor, next time. I'm Kim Anthony. Thanks for listening to this episode of Unfavorable Odds. Unfavorable Odds is produced by Family Life and is a part of the Family Life Podcast Network.